Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Gary.
Hey, Guy. How are you?
I'm good. So we've got a bona fide national treasure this week.
We have. He's become a real superhero of the lockdown period, hasn't he? And maybe when he first started doing his Tim's Twitter listening party on Twitter just over a year ago, we thought, well, this is, how's he going to make it last 12 weeks or whatever Boris was telling us we had?
Yeah, exactly.
And now,
now 17 years later.
But he's had 600 and something Tim's Twitter listening party events, and the world is all listening and tweeting.
Yeah, we are indeed. So let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Toast.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Toast podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hiya. How are you doing? You all right?
You look like you're lying on the floor. Are you lying on the floor?
I am. Is that okay?
Yeah.
That's very cool. It's like interviewing Hugh Hefner.
Right. I'm actually in a recording studio, so this isn't my room, but it's nice to be here.
Whose studio is it?
I'm at Rockfield in Wales, all wearing masks and things like that.
Yeah, are you doing another solo record?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Have you met Guy before, by the way?
Hi, Guy.
Tim, this is Guy.
Hi, Tim. I'll tell you where we met. This is with my weird cop-like memory. We were met twice. Actually, the first time we met was in that little upstairs bar in the Viper Room in about 1996 or 97.
In LA?
Yeah. I was hanging out with Danny Sabre, who I think you knew. Producer, produced Black Grape.
I did know him really well because he produced the Charlatans album in 2001.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was really great. We lost contact now, it was great times.
So how many musicians are you in the studio with?
Good times.
Two others. One is an engineer and they're both engineers and producers, really. But
are these songs you've written already at home?
Yeah. I've got quite a lot.
So you just come up with a song idea, and then you got the two producers to fight it out.
One's more electronic, and the other one plays drums. So it's a nice combination, really.
And I'm so impressed by your workload generally, Tim, throughout your entire career. Yeah. I mean, we keep having artists on here that make me feel so lazy. But how do you work then? Take this new album you're doing now. Have you got a studio at your own house and then you sort of do demos and bring them in?
No, I do them all on voice memos, really, on my phone. And sometimes I use like a drum beat from a YouTube tutorial or something like that, just to keep me in time. I just write at home and just try and do it every day and see what comes out. Really,
I've said, because you put a few new songs up on social media, and I wonder if that's a way of workshopping them and seeing if you think people are going to like them and if it's worth carrying them on.
That's true. Yeah, there's like acoustic guitar versions of them. I bought myself a nice tripod. So that's good for setting up, you know, a little performance and stuff with my iPhone and just record them and see if people like them. So yeah, it's a good way of.
So you're not precious. You're not thinking, oh, I better not give this song away. You know, I want to nurture this until it's an anthem.
No, not really precious.
No, that was more of an insight into Gary's working process there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think my best song yet, I've been keeping precious for 30 years. I just, before we get onto Charlatans and all of your stuff at the beginning and who you really are, we just got to talk about, you know, your pandemic self and
Judi Dench of lockdown.
Yeah, more the Vera Lynn, surely.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you have become a national treasure, Tim. There's no other way of putting
keeping
it.
The home fires burning.
Yeah,
it's an extraordinary thing you've done. I mean, seriously extraordinary. Just to explain a bit briefly, on Twitter you have Tim's Listening Party, and you have a different record a day, or two records, or.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed. Originally, it was just meant to be one, and then it got to three a night very quickly, just because everyone, you know, fancied the idea of joining in. And I suppose it was the beginning of the pandemic, and lots of people were looking for things to do. But, yeah, 7, 8, and 9 o'clock have been the times, really. Or, no, 8, 9, and 10, I should say. Yeah, they've just been going now for... It's almost a year.
And so for anyone who's not... seen it, you know. Yeah. You
Tim's Twitter listening party.
You put the record on of
party, yeah.
The record on of choice, which and there's normally spokesman from the band, someone who's written that record or whose record it is, and everyone puts it on exactly the same time, and we all listen at home together while the person tweets about it and tells us wonderful stories, and Guy and I have did it together with the Source for the Secrets album, and I did it a couple of other times with two other albums, and. Yeah. And it's extraordinary because you've had everybody who's anybody on. You've had Paul McCartney on.
We had Paul McCartney on. Yeah, it was fantastic.
That was extraordinary, yeah.
I just loved the way that Paul McCartney announced that he was going to do it, because I went fishing a little bit and I saw that the album was out, and I kind of tweeted, you know, wouldn't it be great for a listening party at Paul McCartney? And then about 6 weeks later, I just got two thumbs up. And I thought, oh my God, like the greatest response, you know. And so I was very happy with that.
Wow.
I mean, it was amazing him coming. And it was fantastic information as well
Brilliant. Yeah, he was fantastic. I mean, you know, everyone who's taken part, you know, the best ones, you know, I mean, I always say that Gary's was one of my favorites with True. And, you know, it just like the depth of knowledge and depth of information that goes, and you know how much you put into it is the key, really.
What's your criteria to how do you pick your albums? Because there's some great, real deep cut ones.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, there were people that are really new, and then it got to people that I didn't know but admired and was. Just totally thrilled that they were getting on board, but with all that and how it was growing with bigger artists, I wanted to make sure that there was kind of like younger and up and coming artists as well getting involved, and you know, because at that time there was no way for them to promote records, and they might have been putting out their debut and things like that. So I started to, you know, think about how I would feel if it was my debut album and I put all that work in, and you know, and there was no way to promote it, so.
There's absolutely no equivalent to this that's ever happened before, I don't think. You know, I mean, it's not like a DJ like Alan Freeman used to play albums on the radio in the old days. It's not like that, is it? I mean, it's an opportunity that I don't think any fan has ever had. And what I think it's interesting for you is a lot of artists are really tribal, aren't they? They sort of, you know, they sneer at other works and they're very precious about their little corner of their genre. You're passionate about everything in music, aren't you? Does that sum you up?
I'm very passionate about people who make music and how they want to tell their story. Yeah, without a doubt. You know, and it doesn't matter whether I particularly know the artist or whether I actually, you know, own the record. You know, I just like the idea that people are listening, people want to get information, and that the artists are having a great time.
And how did it start, Tim? What was the first? Who was the first band?
What was the actual light bulb moment?
Yeah. Funnily enough, the Charlatans were the first band.
Was it difficult getting them?
Yeah. he couldn't find anyone who knew anything about the record. or shall I say, remembered anything about the record.
It took me about 7 Charlatans albums before I could get anyone else in the band to join in with me.
Nice, miserable lot.
Yeah, but they once they got into it. They really got into it. But I started a long time ago, maybe about 9 years ago, and just doing the Charlatans ones. And because, you know, I was getting more followers, and I just wanted to keep people updated, and I wanted to, you know, more people to know the story. And it wasn't until March 23rd that, you know, lockdown began, and I kind of, yeah, gave it out to other people too. So it was allowing people to use the platform, basically.
And what's it gone to? Because it's such a growing, organically growing thing. I mean, where are you going to take it, Tim?
Well, we just did our 666th listening party, and that was Iron Maiden.
I hope it was a mark. Was it the Mark of the Beast by Iron Maiden?
Yes.
It wasn't. It should have been.
It was Iron Maiden. Yeah. and they did an absolutely amazing listening party, and it was, you know, it was the biggest one.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it was a year. It's almost a year later. It's the biggest one, and
is that because the Maiden fans are just, there's so many of them?
They all came out of the box, and I think what is amazing, Gary, is you know you've had number ones, and Iron Maiden have had number ones too, and you know they've probably played Wembley Stadium or you know wherever, you know, but they never trended at number one on Twitter, and they did, and. And I think that's quite kind of an interesting thing, you know. It's like it's still a quite a, you know it's a.
But it's you know. It's one of the great things about getting older is finding that there's always another box to tick.
Exactly. And I think you know for that to happen, they were trending at number one after the second song.
It's funny, you know, because the world you know is only the world you follow on your social media. So as far as I'm concerned, most people out there are just Bowie fans, pretty much. A few indie fans. You know. But actually, there's a whole metal world, isn't there, on Twitter that is enormous that we never get to peer into. God, you did release The Beast.
Yes, it's huge because there's like we have a replay thing on the listening party now as well. So people can, if they miss out on it, they can wake up.
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant. That I've done that. It's fantastic. Yeah,
fantastic.
The real time threader.
Yes. So and so people were waking up in South America, and all of a sudden they went
wondering how they got there.
Well, it's yeah. But you know, the replay was like that was.
Sorry, he always laughs at his own joke. Sorry, Tim.
Oh, it's fantastic. You know, so that has gone to about 60,000 now, just people watching, you know, from who missed the listening party, but they just kind of tuned in a couple of days later. It's good.
And do you think that when it's all over, you might take the listening party on the road? Is there a way of doing that? Is there a way of getting into a theatre? And because people, I think so.
Well, I think we could find a way. I mean, I've been thinking about it for a long time, but taking them to festivals, you know, where we get the headline band to come and sit down and tweet and people can watch them. It'd be a live event. It'd be kind of funny. Well, yeah,
you could play the music and have their kind of Twitter feed on the screen behind you sort of thing.
Yeah, do it between bands because no one wants an audience who are on their phones.
But I guess you'd like to get out and play live, I suppose, wouldn't you? That's really what you'd like to do. I mean, you made a whole other album. You made an album that came out in lockdown and you're already making your next one. And it's an album that's never been performed on stage. And I think that's generally what's happening to a lot of artists now, isn't it?
That I agree. I think people are just really looking forward to that time where hopefully it'll open. I think you know, I get the feeling it'll open quite slowly, but you know, it'd be nice to dream.
Yeah.
So this we better go back, shouldn't we, Guy? We normally go back at some point.
This where we have the swirly mists of time.
Okay.
To you, imagining yourself as a young man hearing your first record that went, wow, this is who I want to be. And do you remember what that was?
When I heard a record that made me want to be in a band, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that one would probably be, I mean, you know, I knew Bassist Rollers and I knew Slade and my uncle had lots of records, but the first record that I really connected with was Blue Monday by New Order.
That's quite late, really.
Yeah, I mean because they made a record that I thought was really futuristic and they were local So that's what it was. Because I thought everybody came from, you know, I don't know, I suppose Mars or somewhere like that, or, you know, Saturn, who were pop stars. People on the telly didn't really live where I lived, but New Order were local and they made a record that sounded like it came from New York.
Did you buy the 12-inch?
Yes, I did. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
You're one of the people. So you actually helped put them in debt.
Yes, right. I did. Yeah.
why is that? What, I don't know that story. What happened?
Oh, it's brilliant because they assumed that it was going to be a limited edition collector's thing. You know, it was a 12-inch single. So the packaging that, you know, Peter Saville came up with was so beautiful that it actually cost them money for every record they sold. And it then went on to become the biggest selling 12-inch of all time and cost them a fortune.
Yeah, that's true.
But what about Joy Division? Did they not pop into your...
Well, I was a little bit too young for Joy Division, really. You know, I'd heard tracks by New Order before. And you know, I love music. You know, I suppose punk, you know, in 1977, I did decide that I was a punk. But I was, you know, 10 years old. So it was a very youthful movement anyway. Yeah. But you know, I didn't really know what I was claiming to be, but I love that kind of music. But it was, you know, and then I got into second generation kind of like punk, you know, like
post-punk
and post-punk and post-punk and then, but then when New Order came along, I thought, this is a serious band and I'm a serious 16-year-old.
You auditioned, didn't you, though, for the Charlatans, really? Yes. You weren't the first singer, were you?
Yeah, I'd always been in bands and you know, playing keyboards or playing bass or guitar, but never really...
Did you study?
I just, like, tinkered about, really. And then I joined this band called the Electric Crayon Set. They were, like, a psychedelic band. And we supported a band called the Charlatans. Rob from the band and Martin both saw me and thought that maybe I should be their singer.
They were in a different part of the country, though, weren't they?
They were from the West Midlands, but we all actually bought records from this one shop in my hometown, Northwich, which you know, wasn't really famous for anything apart from Northwich Victoria or Witton Albion, I suppose, two non-league football teams. But the band, the Charlatans, would go to this record shop, you know, and actually so would all the, you know, so would New Order, so would the Stone Roses, all, you know, all these bands would go to this one record shop. It's kind of interesting, really.
So good. Tell us about the audition, as it were.
I turned up and they had three instrumentals and I made some lyrics up on the spot and started doing what I thought was a kind of Iggy, Jim Morrison kind of thing. And they stopped the song after it ended, you know, and I just was making the lyrics up on the spot. And they said, should we try it again, but sing this time? So I sang and my voice was like really small and, you know, or I thought quite small, but they liked it, so it was good. Yeah.
And did anything, so out of that first session, did anything come out of that, any of those three songs? Did
all of them made it onto record? Yeah. Right.
But it was that sort of keyboard sound of Rob's,
yes,
was very dominant. And it's interesting you said Jim Morrison, because obviously that they were a very Hammond organ keyboard band, and a lot of what your sound was, you know, was influenced by sort of that West Coast sort of psychedelic sound, a lot of 60s
also
stuff.
Yeah, but also the other one, which another West Midlands group, is especially with the driving thing that you had. I'd say the Spencer Davis group.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah. No, I can hear that.
Yeah.
Stevie Winwood, Hammond.
I mean, you know, Rob, he didn't really like that many bands, really, Rob. He liked the Beatles. He liked Julian Lennon, and he liked... Yeah, and the Brian Auger and Julie Driscoll and the Trinity. And it was like, okay.
Wow.
But, you know, you can see why he liked them for the Hammond. So we were kind of like teaching him new things, you know, like dance music. And I really liked De La Soul at the time. So that was a kind of like hip hop thing. And it was just...
Oh, of course. Which, of course, sampled Gary.
Yes, they did. No, is that right?
Yeah,
that
De La Soul did, didn't
they? Wasn't it?
Was that PM? I don't think De La Soul did, no.
Oh, no, it was PM Dawn. That's right. But they were... But this, Sorry.
That's all right. He doesn't always get his facts right. But did you hear lawyers scurrying at that point? Lawyers scurrying off to contact De La Soul.
Yeah, I was reading your book, Gary. Last couple of days, I picked it up again. I mean, you sent it a long time, but I've been very much enjoying it.
Thank you, thank you.
I was contacted by Celebrity Mastermind. A couple of weeks ago, and I was kicking a few ideas about, and they said, "Have you got any ideas of who you'd want to talk about?" And I said, "Well, I've got this idea about pre-1930s lawnmowers." and he said, "No, that's not very good. That's not very good. Can we go anywhere else?" I said, "How about Guy Pratt?" And they said, "Who's that?" and I said, you know, if you look on musician on Wikipedia, right, that you'll see him there, right? And they said, "What's Wikipedia?"
No, Mastermind.
So I said, "Okay, I'll do one on Gary Kemp."
And you're not, but you're not, surely not. Please don't say that. No.
Yeah, okay. Back to pre-1930s lawnmowers. There's a rich seam here which needs to be mined or mowed.
So hang on, just I want to try and get. I'm going to go pull this back onto track. What year are we talking about for the Charlatans now?
My audition was April '89.
So the whole sort of Manchester thing was beginning to happen. The Stone Roses was beginning to happen.
Well underway,
wasn't it?
It was really because. Yes, it was. We didn't have our first single out until 1990. We were quite late, really.
I remember Blur telling me how that in their early days.
All four of them together.
All four of them together said one boy. It was literally Damon went 1, 2, 3, 4, and all of them went. it was David and Alex. We're saying how what an influence. You know, The Only One I Want was on their early tunes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that song, you know, it was a very early song that we wrote, and when it came out as a single, we were just, you know, in the van and going up and down the country, and we just kept hearing it on the radio, and it was such an amazing feeling hearing it on Radio One, and it was it's like we're just hearing this more and more. What's happening? And more people started coming to the shows, and you know, getting like it became kind of. And for me, Beatlemania, you know, and me and Rob used to watch all these Beatles documentaries, and it was kind of like we were just getting chased all around the country. It was amazing.
Well, I saw you put an old video of yourself performing in the early days up on Twitter the other day. And
oh, yeah.
You were a beautiful boy.
Oh, well.
I mean, really super cute. So, but you know, Indian pop. Kind of, they have this kind of problem with each other, don't they? You know, you're in an indie band, but you're sort of scared of having female followers, you know, because I think there's this strange kind of, and we've spoken about this before, because I only have four subjects and I just repeat them over and over again.
Purchase lawnmowers is one of them.
Well, it will be now. It's that pop music can be quite sexist. It can have this sense that if a band is followed by women, girls, then maybe they're not musically worthy. So, you know, you've got a serious band coming out of the Manchester scene, and how did it feel to suddenly be a pop group? Is that what you wanted?
It felt great. I mean, you know, I had other thoughts in mind of what the band were going to be, but, you know, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. You know, to be in smash hits and to be on the chart show and to, you know, have people recognising what we do was such an amazing thing. I think, you know, as all the members of the band had conflicting opinions, you know, because it, you know, it took us all by surprise, really.
Can I just talk to you a little bit about that whole Manchester scene, which you did get roped into. This is all pre-Britpop, you know. There would be no Britpop, really, if it hadn't have been for what was coming out of Manchester in the late 80s, early 90s. It's such a fascinating moment, isn't it, where
Because you've
house.
Got rock bands and this dance scene and this weird mishmash where it was one of the times where sort of where rock music and dance music weren't mutually exclusive, you know what I mean? It was like they were
through the Hacienda, I guess.
The Hacienda was it was huge, and I used to go there all the time.
What was it like? I don't think I went. I was told, someone told me I'd been, but I don't remember going.
I think that's most people's story of the Hacienda. Yeah. Yeah. So you were there.
Very cold. It was very cold. And you walk through kind of like plastic, you know, curtains. And there's a picture of Tony Wilson.
No, that's what they do after. That's what happens up to you afterwards on a gurney.
You know, it's good. And you walk through, and it was kind of like there's lots of options of like you could go up the stairs or you could go and stand in front of the stairs. You know, it was just a really exciting place to go. And when Thursdays was kind of like the indie night, really. But then Friday and Saturday was the acid house nights, and then the Thursday night began to get more and more acid house as well. So it was just what was popular at the time, really. And I think people love to dance. There's lots of football hooligans and who were kind of like just dancing and letting themselves go, and who would never have danced in public before, you know, kind of just, I guess, ecstasy was a part of it, you know.
Yeah, MDMA.
Yeah. And people just let themselves go and were kind of kind to each other and which was very nice, you know, because for a long time, you know, you know, sometimes you go out as a teenager and you worry about getting, you know, clonked over the head with something. So.
Have you read Hooky's book on the Hacienda?
I haven't because read it all. No.
It's unbelievable. It's like that film Dig or like it's just catastrophe after catastrophe, just unimaginable. It's like every page is, oh my God.
Oh, I must read it.
Of what they put into it. They spent a lot of money on making people very happy.
They just do things like they couldn't be bothered to take the bar money up to the safe. So they leave it behind the bar. And then then at the end of the weekend, someone just nicked it all. And of course it's not insured because they haven't taken it to the safe. And like, it was just, and like stuff like that every week.
But I'm really interested in I'm always interested in the sort of musical passing of a baton or the inspiration coming. Yeah. You know, if you look at early Stone Roses videos, you see, you're basically looking at the Smiths, but with a bit more glam. Yeah. But they've got this drummer. I mean, Rennie is just the most extraordinary drummer that's playing like no one had ever played in rock and pop before, it seems to me, you know. And I think his drumming was such a big influence on a lot of the bands that even yourself, really.
I think so, for sure. I mean, he definitely had the groove, you know, and it was, you know, by him doing
and
that.
And Manny.
Yeah, absolutely. And by them laying down this groove, he kind of like wondered where it came from. And, you know, he kind of traced things back to maybe Sly and the Family Stone and then, you know, other modern dance records as well, which, you know, people were picking up influences from. And we would always go like to after parties, after the clubs, and people would then be playing things like The Birds and Jimi Hendrix. And so it was kind of like almost like just everything. You know, people were just excited about music. I remember going as the Charlatans in 1991, going to America, and the whole of America were looking at British bands, which, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. It, you know, obviously it happened with Gary, but it doesn't happen every year, does it? Where all of a sudden British bands are the band, you know, are the bands, you know.
But I think it was probably the thing with that generation is it's the first time that the actual youth movement around music was about being inclusive rather than being exclusive. You know, used to be about what you don't listen to. Yeah. Whereas with this, for the first time, it started with, you know, when people had started dropping ABBA at kind of house part at sort of acid house nights in Ibiza and stuff. And so for the first time, it was almost like the guilty pleasures thing. It was like, it was cool to admit you liked stuff, you know, which was incredibly beneficial.
It's true. I wonder if that could have come out of London, because I just think London's a bit more, seems to me to be a bit more snobbish and tribal about the kind of music it likes. You know, I'm into techno, I'm not into anything else, but there was you're right. I mean, you're embracing everything from sort of jangle pop and The Birds right through to techno and house, you know, and Chicago stuff.
And Carly Simon, Why, was always the last song.
Really?
Yeah, it was just like so gorgeous. You know,
Bernard Edwards. Bernard Edwards produced that. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you become, you know, a big band. It's an amazing scene. It's all really, in a way, you know, you talk about American bands not having a shoe in there. I guess a lot of it had to do with, this is pre-grunge, right?
Yes, it is. I mean, but yeah, thankfully, yeah, very quickly, because grunge came quite quickly after. I remember us in America supporting Pearl Jam, and all of a sudden it was chaos. You know, it happened quite quickly. You know, things from one thing to another. But
when you went to America, were you kind of embraced by those bands? Or
yeah, I mean, we played an amazing festival in Bremerton, Washington. And that was with Sonic Youth and Beastie Boys and L7. I think it was kind of, you know, I suppose that was, I don't know whether that was grunge or not, but I know, you know, Dave Grohl was there and all them lot. So they must have been all right.
But Americans quite often have always taken British bands as being the real thing, haven't they? That, you know, there's no fakery in a British band, even though ironically we mostly sing in an American accent. Yeah, yeah. Right? Actually, I know you
well,
don't.
No, which actually no, no, I don't. No, but also if you're this is where you Northerners have an advantage, because you say dance
and Bath. You're right, and romance. But no, maybe they don't say romance.
Romance.
How posh are you?
Actually, I just want to talk about your voice for a little while, Tim, because I think you're part of that wonderful sort of British whimsy, or very English whimsy, that sort of came out of Sid and Kevin Ayers.
Yeah.
Kevin Ayers.
And in fact, some of your solo records remind me a lot of Joy the Toy and that whole period of Kevin Ayers' music, you know.
That's the best compliment. Thank you so much.
And that line, isn't it? It really goes back to Sid. When did he start making an impression on you early on as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of leading up to the band, we used to do a cover of Lucifer Sam,
which we do too.
and it's, I mean,
I'd like to hear that.
Oh well, we brought it back, I think, in the early 2000s, but we didn't play it very often. But it was the blueprint in many ways, in my head anyway. I love Sid so much.
But it's a very different kind of singing to the one, say, that your band were doing with, you know, with that kind of West Coast Hammond organ, you know, feel that they had. And I can imagine, you know, you mentioned that story about this, saying, how could you try it again but sing? But it's that juxtaposition of your style and theirs that made your sound quite unique, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, because, well, I guess when I stopped shouting or trying to be Iggy, then I was just me, who you know, I guess it was just a Manchester youngster, just kind of, I don't know, I mean, just such a fan, really. I think that's been my thing.
Because you clearly influenced Liam, I would say.
Well,
yeah, no, 100%.
I think Liam does a really great job, and
no,
he took,
no one's disputing took, that.
Yeah, yeah, but I think he took something and really kind of connected with it and has kept it forever, you know, and it's an amazing thing. And I kind of like feel like, you know, I've probably gone more into a kind of Kevin Ayers-y kind of thing now.
No, but at the time when you started, you and Ian Brown, it was a sense of great, I mean, you know, bravado about what you're doing, and cockiness was a swagger that you both had. You'd both dominate the stages. Yeah. And, you know, his was a little bit more aggressive than yours. Yours was a bit more joyful.
I was hopefully a bit more Jagger, sort of mid Stones period.
but Yardbirds.
Yeah, there you go. Wow.
Wow. That's true. Yeah, the real, it was, yes, it was your hairstyle was very Ralph, wasn't it?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage?
Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
How did you write together, you guys? I mean, okay. Because it always says all your names on the, pretty much always says all your names.
Well, at the beginning, we were so close and we all felt that we were all, looking for something together, and we just played and I'd write songs and say, that's good. Let's chop this up. Some would leave the room. Me and Rob would just be there working out harmonies and things like that. Or Martin and Rob would stay and, we would just always be there. And I think
did it come out of jam sessions?
Yes, it did. It did. The first album for sure. Rob was all over it was Rob's album, really, the first one, I think. Rob and Martin, for sure. He double-tracked every single Hammond organ solo. He just, wow. it was a crazy thing, really, concept. It was a very modern-sounding record, but a very modern-sounding Hammond organ record. And I felt so proud of that record. After that, we didn't want to do that again, so we kind of started looking for other ways of doing things. And I think that meant that every album we did kind of like changed a little bit, which has its good points as well. Rob's playing on that first album is just killer for me,
But there does seem to be a thing with you, with your albums, where there's like a distinct flavor to each one. And I don't know if that's just a natural evolution or you decide, actually, we're going to go more country on this one.
Yeah, we can hear Dylan coming in later on.
I mean, sometimes probably a little too much if I'm being, really honest. But I was so into it at the time. But you see, but Rob, it was really, the saddest thing in lots of ways. He went to prison and then came out of prison and then, and then he died just at the end of this road here where I'm at today.
Extraordinary, wasn't it? It was a car crash, wasn't it?
At the bottom of this road.
And you were right in the middle of recording what was going to end up as probably your biggest album.
Like, yeah, Telling Stories, the fifth album. Yeah.
I know this isn't great, but you might not want to anyway, but tell us about how that, or you got the news and how that affected everything for you.
Well, so I'm in Rockfield now, and he had the car crash at the bottom of the road here, and Kingsley, who owns Rockfield, was the first person to at the accident. Myself and Mark were recording at Mono Valley, which is about a mile and a half down the road, and we'd noticed that the car had disappeared because he was following us, and we just thought that he'd gone for some cigarettes. And about an hour and a half later, the police turned up and told us that it was in hospital and that we should go, So we drove there and we had the radio on, and One to Another was on the radio. And at that moment, I just thought, oh my God, this is like just too much. I was listening to my own lyrics, just thinking, this is just not right. Something's not right. And Mark got out of the car when we got to the hospital, and they told him at the door pretty much that he'd gone.
Oh. I mean, how did you get the band sort of recording again?
Yeah.
We obviously took some time off, and we were supposed to be supporting Oasis at this massive Scottish gig that they were playing, and obviously we couldn't do it because it was after maybe 10 days or something like that. But the following week they were playing at Nebworth, and Jeff Barrett from Heavenly said, you've got to do the Nebworth one. And I was like, well, we can't, we haven't got a keyboard player. and he said that Bobby Gillespie had been on the phone and put Martin Duffy.
Oh, Martin Duffy, yeah.
From The Scream, yeah, forward as Rob's replacement for the night. And Duffy not only played that, but then came to the studio to help us finish the album too, which was, so he was kind of like our angel. During a very, a traumatizing time.
And didn't Liam dedicate Live Forever?
I think so, yeah. I think he did a couple of times, yeah. He dedicated a couple of songs, one in the Scottish festival that they did and one at Nebworth.
Because he's on that album and it becomes your biggest record. The joy was obviously tainted for you all.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I still felt, even though we were playing to our biggest audiences, it's kind of very bittersweet. But it was a very unusual time for us to be playing, you know, Rob stuff. I always think of it as Rob stuff anyway.
You travel about a lot, don't you, Tim? You've lived in, you know, you've done albums in Nashville. I mean, that doesn't sound like, it's funny, boy from your area, neck of the woods, you know, coming out of Hacienda, doesn't, going off to Nashville to do solo albums. I mean, well, the bit I'm interested in as well, you can tell us your story, is what, you know, this idea of you coming in and out of the Charlatans, doing your own thing, solo record, the Charlatans still keeping playing, you know, because so many bands just can't manage to stay together and you guys do. And, yeah, and you're living in LA as well, bumping into Guy. But
yes.
How do you juggle? Yeah. let's start with Nashville. Why did you go to Nashville to do a solo album?
My friend Kurt Wagner is in a Nashville band called Lamb Chop, and I went to see him play a solo show in Manchester, and he had a bad back, so I carried his equipment out to the van.
Aren't you good?
Yeah. Were you carrying Guy's equipment? Was he carrying your equipment, Guy, when you met him? They've all carried your equipment, love.
Anyway, and he said, we should write together. And he said to me, you write the music and I'll write the words. And I thought, okay, that's a challenge. And he just thought it was a great idea. So we started there and then.
Yeah. It's funny because... because now the entire, what's weird is we always thought of Nashville as the country place, but the entire music business is basically in Nashville now. Practically every musician I know in America, all the people I know who used to live in New York or LA, they've all moved to Nashville. It's where it all, you know, it's all the heavy metal bands, everyone. They're in
really?
Nashville.
Really?
Funny.
Well, yeah. I really wanted to make a kind of, you know, a soulful, gospel-y kind of thing, you know, and I wanted to write with my friend. You know, I think cities have really wonderful sort of musical stuff. You know, I mean, I moved to LA because of Gram Parsons and because of the Beach Boys. You know, I moved to London probably because, you know, of all, you know, music there and everything was going on there. And Manchester, I was radiated to from Northwich, Cheshire, you know.
But in many ways, I get the West Coast of America with the Charlatans. It's another part of your spiritual home, isn't it? But how did it work being in living in LA and then having a band? How did you go?
Really difficult, but we did it. And I didn't realize how difficult it was for the band, really.
No one thought to follow you.
Well,
they originally moved from the West Midlands up to Northwich, LA. But somehow LA is you know, it's not as appealing as Northwich.
Isn't that crazy? I love LA so much. I just love it, you know.
Yeah, I lived there for 3 years. I have to say, it's very inspiring creatively because everyone's always working, aren't they? Yeah. No matter, you know, even when you're not working, you're working because you're reading a script or you're, you know, I'm just fiddling with your guitar in the back porch. That's working in LA.
Yeah, it's very laid back. it's great, you know. I lived in a really great part of town. I was in Hollywood, you know, by the Capitol Records building. It was, you know, it's fantastic. I could walk around, you know, it was like, you know, I just had the best time. Mark would come and Tony would come. And then we recorded with Danny Sabre at his house on Wonderland Avenue.
It
was a really great experience. I think if we had records that were considered, you know, our best, I'd say that Some Friendly, Telling Stories, Wonderland.
A bit much more sort of America went into Wonderland, didn't it? It was a much more of a soulful kind of record.
Yeah, it's very, very soulful. Lots of samples. I was listening to, I sang everything in falsetto for some reason.
It's Curtis Mayfield in your mind.
That might have been the reason.
Brian Wilson.
Yeah, definitely Curtis Mayfield and a little bit of Neil Young, I think. You know, kind of Fragile, After the Gold Rush kind of era, Neil Young. Yeah. They were the things that I was into. We had Jim Keltner come up. He carried his drums upstairs, and he played, and he was wonderful. We had Daniel Lenoir.
Is there never any crew around you a lot? Either you're carrying someone's gear, Jim Keltner's carrying his own gear.
I'm always loading. I'm always loading from a car to a studio. Yeah, there you go.
You love collaborating, don't you? You've done so much of it. Different, you know, from classical music people to techno people, Chemical Brothers.
Yeah.
When you go, I'm terrified of of collaboration as a, you know, because I always think, you know, what's expected of me? What have I got to deliver? Shall I prep it all over here first and then jam it in? How do you approach it?
Well, you know, sometimes like that. But I often go quite prepared in my own mind. And then when the connection is made with the people, everything changes. With the Chemical Brothers, I had some ideas and I just couldn't remember them when I actually got in the studio. So I just kind of, we just fed off each other and, you know, did things very, very, you know, in a very small way until it grew and, you know, kind of quite organically. My first major collaboration was with the Chemical Brothers, really. And I'll always remember that time.
That worked out great, didn't it?
It really did. Yeah, I've done a couple. And they did like lots of remixes for us. And it just became a big part of the Charlatan story, really.
There's something I forgot to mention earlier was I noticed that Steve Hillage was one of the producers.
Oh, I love Gong.
On what album was he working on?
Up to Our Hips.
Up to our hips. Because Steve came along to see us play, didn't he? And we were all sort of worst, didn't he, Guy?
Because funny, it was the first time Nick Mason had seen him for 30 years because Nick produced two of his albums.
Oh, wow.
But he produced Green.
Wow. I love the album L.
Right.
It's got a cover of Hurdy Gurdy Man on it. Which is just brilliant. I mean, I love Steve. We were looking
How did it work?
Well, we were looking for a producer and we couldn't decide on anyone. And then Steve Hillage walked into our lives and we looked at him and we just thought, he has the kindest eyes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what a vibe. And, you know, we just all loved him. It was amazing.
You kind of realised he might have been the vibe man in the room.
Yeah, exactly. He's just a wonderful, wonderful person. And, you know,
he's lived in the same flat in Notting Hill for like 40, 50 years. I still see him in the street all the time. And he is just the nicest man. Yeah. Also, the most brilliant reinvention with the whole System 7 thing. You know, he's fantastic.
But well, that's interesting to see, because this is the, I love this program because of all the connections we make. But, here's a band, the Charlatans, who are born out of psychedelia and out of techno. And that's Steve Hillage, isn't it, really? He's gone down both roads too.
Yeah.
And I think that's how we kind of got in touch with him, really, because he'd been playing on the Orb records with
with a lot.
Oh, fantastic.
My old schoolmate. Yeah, my old schoolmate, Youth.
Wow. And they're all interested in it all as well, aren't they? You know, and that's...
Absolutely.
If you're interested in it all, then it kind of like, you just remain interested and hopefully make good stuff.
Yeah. So the Charlatans, I know you're doing a second solo album off the bat. And I guess, in a way, solo albums are kind of all you can do now at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, at the moment, yeah.
Because I was wondering, Tim, if you feel you have stuff that you can't say with the Charlatans, if you know what I mean?
There is that. I mean, the Charlatans, it's a completely different thing. You know, we all get together and bring things, unfinished things together. And see if it kind of works, you know. With my stuff, I just write the songs. I say just write the songs. Come up with a song. go through hell writing the song. And then try and work out the best way for people to be able to listen to them. And I find that kind of quite, you know, obviously in this situation, it's easier than saving them and waiting for the band. But, you know, the band are... will meet very quickly as soon as lockdown's over, you know.
So I guess the beauty of a solo album is you can have all kinds of different instrumentations on a track, where with a band you're sort of limited to the sound of that band, aren't you?
I think we've always tried to be open, you know, with what the Charlatans can sound like. What would be amazing is to actually all find out together, you know, the audience to find out what kind of sound we're going to make, the band to find out what kind of sound we're going to make. We don't know, and that's a good thing.
Just really wanted to, you know, mention your drummer, your first drummer.
John.
Who died, and, you know, what a great player he was. Incredible player, and so important in the band's sound.
Yeah.
And again, you managed to pick yourself up and restart. Yeah. It's very hard to know what your identity is when you lose such key members.
It really is. I mean, I was looking at some photographs Because our first guitarist left after the first album. And so, you know, I was looking at photographs from the first album and there's only two of us left. It's kind of very strange. So John died after a 5-year battle with cancer. And it was, you know, just awful. You know, we lost Rob in an instant. But we saw our friend have to battle through a terrible illness. Yeah, this is very sad.
I think there's something. It's very hard when it happens in bands because we're all Peter Pan when we're in a group, aren't we?
Yes.
We're carrying our youth around with us. We're carrying that first incarnation of who we were when we were kids, forming a group. There are pictures and films of us everywhere as young men, and we still walk on stage believing we are those people. And then suddenly age and time and ill health can catch you up sooner than you think.
It was very disturbing because John actually first found out the same time as everybody else found out when he was actually playing drums and had a seizure on stage. So we were in America and, you know, obviously the tour was cancelled and John was in hospital and it was all very, like you say, you know, humbling, to say the least. Yeah,
it draws you together, though, right?
As far as identity goes, I don't think we lost our identity. I think, in some ways, John solidified it. Him dying, really kind of brought the band back together in a lot of ways. And we made an album called Modern Nature that I think certainly the fans seem to think that it's one of our best.
It's great, right?
And it was inspired by, it was, you know, we just kind of, after John's, 5-year illness, we just all kind of, the four of us got back into the studio with a microphone like that one, Gary, just sort of like in the middle of the room. And we just sort of like started kind of singing, really, you know, kind of. And then we didn't have a song at all. And we just started singing and putting a few ideas down. And by the end of the day, we had our first song and it was like, oh, we can do this. You know, this is kind of quite good. And then we had some help from Stephen Morris from New Order, which was fantastic. And Pete Salisbury from The Verve and a few other people. And, you know, within a few months, we had an album that, and we really believed that John was with us making that record, you know. His memory, at least.
But you know what's sweet was talking about, if we go back right now to the very, very beginning, when you're talking about New Order and saying how bands didn't come from where you were. And now everyone you've just talked about, and everyone, this whole musical sort of landscape of the past 30 years is people from where you were from. Mm.
Yeah, well, Johnny came and played on one of those records as well.
Johnny Marr.
You know,
You must have done stuff at his house, didn't you?
We have done stuff. I did a Curtis Mayfield song at his house. It turned out really bad because I was wasted. But we've done stuff.
Was Johnny tutting?
Johnny's played with us quite a few times on stage, and I asked him to come over for a cup of tea. We were making an album called Different Days, the Charlatans' most recent album, and he came over and he stayed and played on about four songs, I think. So I told him to bring his guitar and he did.
So that's good. Brilliant.
Oh yeah, carry it yourself. Or did you carry him?
Tim, I know we were meant to have a cup of tea and then it all went into lockdown, didn't it?
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to having that cup of tea.
Well, I was going to ask you if you'd like to play on my album, Gary.
Whoa!
I would love that. I would love that. We'll make that happen.
Yeah,
we'll make that happen.
I think I've got the right song.
We'll have a chat.
Okay.
Privately when guys are away.
I forgot we were on air.
If you do need a bass player,
I would love that.
Guy could send you his CV.
More than happy.
I would absolutely love that.
He could send you his CV. Yeah. He's played on The Wurzel. Shut up. No. and some little guy called Michael Jackson. yeah, listen, we'd both love that. Thank you so much for doing our show.
Yes, absolute Tim, pleasure.
Absolute delight.
Lovely to see you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you for, on behalf of everybody, I reckon, just thank you so much, Tim, for
a grateful nation.
Thank you.
A grateful, definitely.
100%. 100%.
Yeah.
Loved it.
So amazing.
Brilliant.
He's such a nice man, isn't he? I mean, really, no ego. And two, you know, difficult story at times, you know, which I thought he told rather movingly.
He did tell it very movingly. I thought you handled it very sensitively, Gary. Well done.
Well, I know. I think that was quite extraordinary. I loved him. I loved him. I think he's great. He's great.
I loved him. I think he should be offered a gong, even if it's just so he can turn it down.
Yes. A Steve Hillage gong.
Oh, very good.
Anyway, we've got some great guests coming up. I know we have. I've seen the list and I know who's been banging on our door saying, please, can we do the Rock on Tours? It's getting really good, isn't it?
It is getting really, really good. And keep those reviews and ratings coming and keep it here.
Subscribe, hit the button, and we will see you next week. And thank you to Ben, our producer. And it's good night from me.
And good night from her.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.